News Talk Saturday.
These people that I'm going to describe now seem magnetic, generous, and deeply interested in you. But slowly the dynamic shifts and your boundaries begin to disappear. Who are these people, these master manipulators and narcissists? Joining me now is clinical psychologist Stephanie Regan to talk about and unpack how they use their charm, grooming and subtle psychological tactics to infiltrate relationships, gain control and keep it. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning, Emmett. Nice to talk to you.
It's great. And I said I probably made it sound a little bit more sinister in the intro, but we'll talk about it in its ordinary manifestation. So narcissists and manipulators, just draw me a picture of the type of person you're referring to.
Yes. And I think manipulator is almost a better word because things get a bit caught up in the narcissistic kind of label. I think there's been a bit of overexposure on that and people feel it's only one type. Whereas the way that I would look at things is that, of course, the narcissist has some very obvious manipulative kind of tendencies, especially in the romantic. But it looks like somebody who, if you think about it this way, manipulators scan for unmet needs. They look around them. They see the world that way. They are in many ways meeting their own needs in a dishonest way by manipulating what is outside. Whereas for the rest of us, we kind of move along in a more transactional kind of way. But they have a world view, often quite unconscious, that is steering them to be manipulative. I think that's quite important because often when they understand what they're doing, they have a tendency to be able to shift a little bit. The problem is they don't tend to look inward very much. They're not the reflective type.
Now, I suppose one, would they have measures of intelligence that are quite high, or is that just a stereotype I have? In other words, they would sound to me clever, at least in the conventional sense.
I don't think that it goes with intelligence, I have to say. I've never encountered that. I think it goes with some internal insecurity, usually an emotional insecurity. They don't feel safe in the world. They don't feel safe in relationships. They follow a worldview that is usually quite simplistic. I mean, Trump is the obvious example. You know, he sees things as good and bad, winners and losers, black and white, power and weakness. So he's looking, if you think of it, he is looking at the world like he has to win. Now, you can look around that in all sorts of ways. But deep down, he doesn't have a place for, you know, negotiation unless he's going to be the winner.
Now, do we all have a little bit of this in us in the sense that we're all ultimately, and I stress that word, self-interested at some level because we need shelter, food and all the rest of it. So is this like a continuum? In other words, these people that you're mentioning have what we all have, but they've just taken it and distorted it out of all shape.
Yes, I think so. I think so. And I mean, can we just mention a few other types of manipulators? Because I think that's interesting. You know, we all would have remembered the victim kind of manipulator, you know, who always is the person, you know, who has, you know, they need your help and they're always in that helpless kind of position. So are they manipulating? Yes, they are. From their worldview that they don't feel safe unless they've got help and unless they don't become the person who steers thing. They like other people to steer it, and from there they feel safe. So you see people who are very insecure, for example, and they control. So they control their other partner. Is that manipulation? Yes, it is. So it is a continuum. There are many kinds. We also see the passive aggressor kind of manipulator. You know, the person who, you know, they hold their anger in, if you like, but they still control in a kind of a nice way, but they let, you know, the anger can leak out later. So there's many other ways that people manipulate. And I think they're worth thinking about the Machiavellian type who charms all the time, you know, but in many ways is strategically controlling and holding on, you know, sort of giving out those little treats.
Yeah, we had a
spirited way for a purpose.
Sure. We had a spirited discussion earlier in our paper review section of the show in the first hour. And a lot of people were talking about Jeffrey Epstein. And they used this word about him that he was a networker, was the word used by a lot of people. So putting people together, putting ideas together, putting business opportunities together in some kind of circle. Is that something that, like, is that a red flag or is that just perfectly normal networking that only in his case looks strange? But that word stuck with me for some reason.
Well, yes, I know. It struck with you. I would see it in that context. I would see it as he used that, He used that strategy, surely, to build his network, to build his wealth, and to utilize people. So I don't think networking per se is in any way toxic. Networking is a good thing, you know, in normal circumstances. It's what it's used for, isn't it? And you said at the beginning, what does it look like? I think it's really important that people see that. I only spoke yesterday with somebody who had begun a big relationship. They were 8 weeks in and now they were out. It was over. And it was a lot to do with this high sort of intensity of compliments, of gifts, of energy together, lots of love, lots of declarations, all very, very early. And so no natural growth. So this kind of love bombing really is intended to distract and to make you feel, you know, to fast track trust, as we would say. You know, it's really just about fast tracking everything. And you have to be very careful of that in relationships.
Now, a lot of people will be, well, not a lot of people, some people may be looking across at their partner. Maybe it's not going well. Maybe there's certain traits they've identified that give them concern. Maybe they're in the early stages of the relationship. Is there red flags that they, listening to you, that you'd say just, that's important what you've just seen there?
Yes, I think it is important. I think love bombing is a problem in relationships, and I think both sides have to be careful of it. It's jumping across fences. It's the same, you know, you will see it in any kind of, you know, situations of what we would call kind of any toxic kind of abusive situations. Like, we also think of these things in terms of grooming as we knew it in the paedophile sense or the predator sense, that it is about, you know, a kind of giving treats, bringing, you know, lowering people's defenses, gradually kind of moving the boundary, you know. So nothing bad is done immediately, but it incrementally happens. Something, because we are kind of hardwired to think about behavior and to judge behavior in line with what happened last. So we're kind of judging it against what we saw last. So therefore, if the shift is incremental, your guard doesn't go up as much, you know. And in the same way, we would see it with, you know, there's a kind of a normalization of behavior. I mean, we've seen this in many, many areas of, you know, kind of toxic situations. So things get normalized. They get normalized because we are hardwired to think that if there's lots of other people there and they think it's okay, then it's okay. And we kind of lower our own judgment. So it's the areas where we are inclined to lower our judgment, to change what we would normally think is okay, then you probably are kind of being manipulated. So that's kind of, I suppose, my area of viewing and looking when I'm with people clinically.
Now, this is a big question I'm going to ask you now. Can people de-narcissize, if that's a word? Can they change? Because we have this sense of lock-in, you know, people don't change. And certainly as they get older, they tend to go back to their normal behavior that they can depend on almost. Or am I being too pessimistic? People can make big changes. They can reshape their personality types. I mean, that's a huge question across psychology, I understand. But what are your thoughts?
No, I don't think it is a huge question. I think it's a really important question. I think that people, there is this sense that things are fixed. And, you know, obviously I work clinically. I see how much people can change. But I tell you, they can only change if they want to change. They have to, because there's effort in change. You have to see the sense of changing. And I think that, I mean, I have definitely met a number of narcissistic, you know, type, personality types who have made changes. But remember that the depth of the hurt, it really does depend on the depth of the gap that is in them. Are they prepared to look at their worldview? Are they prepared to rethink it, reformulate it, and to test it against somebody else's reality besides their own? Remember, often, we know the Trump story, he came up in quite a severe household. So the marks that are made in us emotionally and psychologically are made quite early, and they go quite deep. So they have to come to a point where they're ready to look at them. And obviously people, this where, as I say, the sweet spot of therapy, that is where people come to therapy. When they come, a bit like addiction, narcissists are the same. They only come when the deal hasn't worked, when all the little skills and all the little manipulations have fallen on their face once again, where the person they loved has walked away or their children won't talk to them. So these are the kind of situations where people find they have to rethink themselves. They have to really honestly say, I'm doing something wrong here. And then they come to us or to me. And okay. Yes, that's where turn and change can happen.
Okay, well, it's good to hear that that is possible. One of the things I see coming through with the narcissistic personality is this constant need for fuel, which is, and the fuel is affirmation. feedback, whatever word you want to use. And we all like that. You know, everyone in our job likes to be told you've done a good job or whatever. I get all that. But the sheer amount of affirmation President Trump needs, I mean, it's he's talked about the Nobel Prize being on Mount Rushmore. He wants certain pieces of bridges and roads named after him. He's always constantly carping on about the media don't give him any credit, all that. So this constant need, even though he's won two elections out of three, this constant need for affirmation, it seems to be a thirst that cannot be quenched with him. Is that part of the whole narcissistic
personality? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's very much part of the empty. There is an emptiness within that most of us don't feel. And it does come from early rearing and, you know, early situations. But he is in many ways trying to fill that gap all of the time. And as you say, it is almost like an unquenchable thirst. You can also see, as you say, he's looking for attention, 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 the deal, the deal, the deal. He also uses conflict to be in the media. Every single day, he nearly doesn't care what it is, doesn't care what he has to say. As long as he's in there and you're talking about him, he feels that he is winning in this war, this internal worldview war that he has of his own. He's the winner. Because if he is not the winner, he's the loser. It's so simple in his world. Now, in narcissists, they're not as extreme as him. He is, let's be honest, at the end of that spectrum. Normally, what you will meet are people who like to be the center, who are more, who are hunger for the center. And they are the people who, I used to often say, that, you know, you will meet these people and they kind of wrap themselves around a little disaster. So it might be your disaster or your sadness, but they take it to themselves. Like, somebody has, there's a death, for example, in a family or an illness. And this person who's narcissistic is inclined to view that in terms of how this affects me.
Yes. I know your brother passed away. Let me tell you about my family.
Yes. But also you would hear people saying like, oh, my mother was sick. You know, that's going to mean I can't go on my holidays. And you kind of feel, oh, that's
strange.
That's a big jump. That's a big jump. So it's that gap that they're not feeling the empathy that is normally felt. The empathy and the feeling is more for themselves all the time. And that's why they're hard to deal with. That's why they're a little bit dangerous for people, because your feelings really are not coming into play in the 50-50 way that you would expect in a relationship.
Now, lots of people, of course, want to explore the gender dimensions of all of this, if there are any gender dimensions. Somebody saying, I'm on the dating scene and there are as many narcissist males as females out there. So is, and I know I'm placing you in dangerous terrain here, but is there any gender part to this story and or this conversation?
My understanding is that I can't give a definitive on that, but I've been very conscious of narcissistic mothers because they look after children, of course, and we would meet that a lot in the clinical work. I think I would expect it to be somewhat even, isn't it? I may have to sort of, and I give that with the caveat that I haven't actually looked up the stats on that, but I'll give you my clinical response. I think that it is equally toxic, and whether it is for women or for men. In the romantic, I would see more narcissists in the male side. And of course, in the rearing sense, I would see more narcissism in the mothering. That's where I find myself dealing.
Now, I suppose my background is more in the power area, like studying power, political power, economic power and all that. And you can look at all of this, I suppose, in a power sense, you know, like those that have it can make those without it do stuff they don't want to necessarily do. We saw that through Epstein and so on. So just bring in the power part for me into this conversation, because that may explain a lot of this stuff more than personal sort of behavioral traits. It may just be the structural power somebody has over another person.
Well, I suppose I see power and control to me are almost similar. You know, if I have power over you, I have control over you. And I have a control over what you do to me and how you make me feel. And I think that's what people are, that's the driver. You know, that's the, as I said, the undertow. That's what's going on in the unconscious that's driving this. So for me, the power and control, they are, you know, that's kind of being engineered. It's been manipulated. You know, it's being managed by the manipulator, if you like. And it's all about having, you know, access to something that they want, and they are reading you to give you what you want. That's another point I think that's really important to say, is that people feel really badly when they've been manipulated. They are ashamed. And of course, that, you know, when it's found out and otherwise, and they realize it. But the truth is, along the way, they are inclined to be, how would I say, they're inclined to feel a sense of sort of going along with, and that going along with, they keep postponing their judgment. When they finally come to it, they do feel shame.
Listen, before you go, I just want to make, because you're under pressure of time, can you just give some very brief advice to someone who's literally, this has been a very theoretical discussion, but somebody who's very much feels they're being groomed or controlled right now, what should they do?
Well, I think key thing is step back a little. You don't always have to make declarations. Just step back, create space from phone calls, texts, move yourself back a little bit, even psychologically. Don't try to argue things out. Don't try to fight things out. Try to just give yourself a little bit of peace and range to hear yourself again, because really that's what gets a little bit lost. Sorry, there was one thing, Emmett, and I'm reverting to it in the middle of that point. What I really wanted to say was people feel a lot of shame. And I always find myself coming back to people and saying, you must understand you're in the hands of somebody who manipulates instinctively. They are experts at it. They're doing it all of the time, and they're doing it instinctively, and they're very good at it. You dealt in the truth, and you don't have to be ashamed of that. It's really important that people don't feel, you know, shame around that.
Well, that's a good,
you know, what silence and shame does to people.
That's a good positive reinforcement point. Listen, we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating stuff. We'd like to talk for you longer, but that's unfortunately the clock can't let us do that. Stephanie Regan is a clinical psychologist. Thank you for joining us.
News Talk Saturday.